A man plays a piano with his feet.
Here we go again, 1, 2, 3, do you wanna come and join in the dance with me?
My name is Roger Grafe. 50 years ago, I made a film about an Australian boy named Brett Nielsen.
Footage of the boy, who having no arms, beats a drum with a stick held between his toes and applies a screwdriver to a tricycle using pincers attached to a prosthetic arm. Now Brett is an adult.
I've come to Australia to find out how Brett has survived the last 50 years.
He takes a cigarette paper from its packet with his foot and drives a motorised lawnmower and a car.
I catch myself out, you know, occasionally. It makes me laugh when there's someone around who doesn't have any arms, and my first thought is, oh, poor bastard, I wonder how he manages, you know?
You're on Bay FM, amongst other things. It's 21 past four now, and it's Friday afternoon. For all of those who may have forgotten, no, it's Friday.
Ask me why I wore no shoes upon my feet.
I know I don't have any arms, but it's not sort of a major part of the day, you know? It's sort of a, oh, yeah, that's right.
Brett, a life with no arms. Driving past trees.
The last time I saw Brett was in England. He was four and being fitted for artificial arms. When he was six, his family moved back to Australia and we lost touch.
Hello, Roger.
Hi, Brett. How are you doing?
Good. How are you?
Good to see you. Can I help you?
Absolutely. Good. How are you?
You too.
50 years, eh?
Yeah,
50 years. Bad. You haven't changed at all. You know, taller.
You said something that you solve problems, every day you're solving problems. You know, reinvent the wheel, that was it.
Whoops.
Wow. Wow, that came out quickly.
That was good.
Suddenly.
It's immediately clear that a great deal has happened in 50 years. Brett has had three marriages and two children. 20-year-old Pasha from one ex-wife and 12-year-old Jack from his third. And he has a new serious girlfriend, Helen, a flight nurse he met 4 months ago.
And we got some grapes from our garden as well.
Are these your grapes? Mm. Who is it that broke up these various marriages and relationships?
In my marriages, I think all my wives ran away from home was my perception. Obviously, they weren't happy. Apparently, I'm a little bit intense at times, you know, a bit like a steam train, but Helen doesn't think they do, darling.
Helen Shute.
The thing that attracted me the most about Brett was our common values, and we exchanged a lot of written stuff because it was a distant relationship, and he's quite a gifted writer, and so he would paint these images, and I really got to know him. It almost sounds a bit old-fashioned, like the old letter way, really. And I just fell in love with that, being romanced by the written word and flowers in the post. I mean, yeah, he's a good find.
Seeing Brett as head of the family takes me back to filming him in the 60s when he was the youngest at the table.
He was pretending to be his father, you see, and he said, I'm Peter Nielsen, and I've got three sons. And I said, oh, yes. And what are their names? And he said, well, one is Mark, and he teases. And one is Carl, and he cries. And one is Brett, and he's got no arms.
Total disbelief to think that a tablet that had been given to ward off morning sickness would create this sort of problem.
The tranquilizer thalidomide was a global commercial success story in the 50s that became the greatest medical disaster in history. It is now believed that at least 100,000 babies in 46 countries were either destroyed or damaged by the drug. Some parents were advised to put their babies straight into care or even leave them to die.
I was hoping to actually see the birth, and I was kept well away, and it was possibly a couple of an hour or so after the birth before I was told that there was an abnormality. And I found it a bit hard to deal with.
In the summer of 61, thalidomide was discovered as the cause of the global spike in birth defects. Damage to the fetus was done in the first 42 days of pregnancy, depending on which day it was taken. The 20th caused brain damage. The 21st and 22nd, eyes and ears. The 24th affected arms. In Australia, Brett's mother, Barbara, took just one tablet from a sample given by her GP on what must have been her 24th day.
Cheers, Roger.
Cheers, Brad, buddy.
Cheers.
Cheers.
Brett worked all his life until he retired 5 years ago, but he's still very busy. For 30 years, he made his living as a record producer and ran a bulldozing business. Now he's about to release a CD of his own songs and is building a house next door for his dad.
You'll be happy to know I've actually thought about giving up smoking recently. No, seriously. There's a lot happening apart from building the shed and a house for the old man. We've just finished the album and doing a new website and getting the infrastructure together for the business, you know, for flogging CDs again. And Dad's moving in, which is a big one. And I'm having a romance as well. So, you know, I mean, there's a lot going on over the next few weeks. All good. All good.
Don't do this at home, kids.
Brett's independent life was established early on by his parents. They refused advice to put him into care and instead treated him as a normal child.
We had decided the only thing to do was to possibly go to England, where there were far more children. And we had been in correspondence with the Thalidomide Association over there, so that we could actually achieve something worthwhile for Brett.
This choice wasn't easy. Victims' families were struggling on their own, emotionally and financially. So the Nielsens sold everything and moved to Britain. There were many more families with affected children sharing advice, and the best artificial arms were being made there.
The Nielsen search began 12,000 miles away in Australia. Powered limbs are so new that they had to come all the way to England to find them.
That's when I first met Brett and his family.
That's where these were hidden, in the newspaper.
Come on, we'll take them out. We'll take them out.
Given the 50-year gap, I'm keen to see pictures of Brett growing up.
Maybe.
Yep, that's me.
Oh, wow.
Oh.
A young Brett with two other boys.
There's you.
There's young Dad. It's like a smooth haircut. You're so cute.
Young Brett.
Young Bretto.
This is boarding school.
Jack. Check out Dad. Wait, 73
is gonna be 13.
That's Dad at your age, and you've got the same hairdo as well.
Oh, wow.
Oh, here's Mum. Me and Mum.
Aww.
I remember Brett's mother, Barbara, vividly from the original film. She was amazingly resilient and key to ensuring Brett had a normal childhood.
We felt that rather than treat Brett gently, we should make every effort to treat him as near as possible as a normal child, because he was going to grow up in a normal world where people will say hurtful things, where whilst he may be quite an adorable little thing whilst he's a baby, he won't be very adorable when he's 15 or 18 or 25. So he must compete with others.
She played an important role in the whole of their upbringing, there's no question of that. And that showed very eminently when we were down at the hospital the evening she died. The emotions that were displayed there were phenomenal.
Hello, Brett. How are you this morning? Can't you see us at nursery school?
She was the one that sort of got Brett to sort of do things that were probably outside of his normal comfort zone. I guess more important, they're outside of a lot of other people's comfort zone. So he wasn't going to get away without doing the washing up. Okay, you had to sit on a draining board to wash up. It was still, if it was your turn, it was your turn. So she didn't want him to be special in a way that made him stand out for the wrong reasons. He wanted him to be special for the reasons like his music or whatever.
When Brett was a tiny baby, I used to take him out to the shops and the clinic and whatnot, as much or possibly more than I used to take the other children, because I thought that let him get used to being stared at and poked, as some people do, right from birth. Better to be used to half a dozen stares every day of the week than to just suddenly get a half dozen every Sunday.
I think she had some very hard social interactions with people because they would see her with Brett and they would only think the worst, so...
Sometimes people have come up in the street and said, did you take those drugs? They somehow think that one is a drug addict, a narcotic, mm-hmm. addict narcotics, and so they think that these mothers have brought this on the child themselves. Now, for quite a long time, it would hurt, but mothers who keep their children at home so that they may protect themselves and their children from stares and from these unkind remarks are really making the burden far greater because the child must come out into the world someday.
The adult Brett's behind the wheel of his car.
Going shopping with Brett, it's clear the awkward outings with his mother prepared him for his confident shopping trips today. For a start, he shamelessly parks in the disabled bay without an official permit.
We'll go and park in the spastic spot because it's nice and close.
In the supermarket.
In the prawns?
Hi, Richard.
G'day, mate.
How are you, mate? Good.
How are you?
Good, 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 good.
You're a very strong person, Mum. Didn't take no for an answer, ever. Yeah, no, she was a classic.
Middle. Okay, thank you very much.
She used to always be finding little sayings and God knows what, and one of them I pulled off a fridge. And the line was, it doesn't matter what happens to you in your life, it matters how you deal with it. But, you know, these are the things that shape your personality and all of that sort of stuff.
Quite one such a big piece. And that one looks like it's been run over by a truck. Let's not have that one.
We won't have the run over truck one then.
No.
No, okay.
This one will do.
Back home.
Okay, listen. Jack, you need to wash your hands, get all that oil off them now, darling. I park in the spastic spot because I can. And Pasha hates it.
Because Dad parks in the disabled spot in a two-door Mercedes. It just looks ridiculous.
Why? No,
because Dad has no sticker and he's driving a two-door convertible Mercedes.
What's a car got to do with anything?
Because the
it's
disabled
a parking spot.
The disabled spot's for someone in a wheelchair, Dad.
No.
Or
it's
someone
it's,
with
it's,
bad
it's,
legs.
It's,
but Brett, there's a catch. You're not disabled.
Yeah, but you know.
Exactly. Oh, you're disabled.
And I don't have a sticker.
Yeah, you're disabled when it means parking at the front of Woolworths. Mm.
Well,
then yeah. I really just need the car here.
Look, I'm
I
an easy target, Pasha.
Without it.
I'm an easy target.
I
it
have
make
no
it feel
arms.
Better.
Why would you move me out of this parking
Pasha,
spot?
Stop being disloyal.
I need
to
help.
Stop being disloyal to that.
Okay, Pasha, I'm an easy target. You know, go hard. You know, make you feel better. It's fine.
Do you remember me telling you about Brett last week? Remember me telling you that when his mummy made him, there wasn't quite enough to make arms? And how lucky you are that when you were all made, your mummy managed to make arms for you.
Getting Brett and other affected children into a normal school was the aim of the original film. It wanted to show reluctant head teachers that children without all their limbs actually used more of their brains than other children.
Black and white footage of a teacher talking to Brett in a classroom.
He's grown up with the fact that he hasn't any arms and he accepts things so completely as they are. And he doesn't mind if the children say to him, where are your arms? He'll answer them quite sensibly. It's the parent who's much more worried than the child about it. I suppose it's just an inborn fear of any kind of physical deformity. Some people just can't accept it.
To help Brett fit in, he wore an artificial arm in infant school. Getting him arms was the reason his parents spent everything on moving to the UK. They hoped this was the key to a normal life, but it was far from straightforward for Brett.
Let me see if you can press straight. If you press it one side, Brett, it comes up. If you press it the other side, it goes down. Right, now you press it with your chin for a minute. That's it.
The movements are simple, but the apparatus is complex, especially for a little boy or girl to live with. It will take 12 days just to fit the jacket properly. And, as he grows, Brett must return for a new arm every 6 months.
We tried just about everything over there. The best that was available at that stage was the gas-operated units.
Its power comes from compressed gas kept in a cylinder on the child's back and is controlled by switches under the chin.
Working?
Yes.
Try the elbow. That's a shot.
But dressing a child in a prosthetic each morning is a fairly lengthy process, and with Brett bitching that it's hurting here and it's hurting there.
No!
Oh, you'll forget all about it.
No, let's get a little pull over on shirt.
Where does it hurt?
On his shoulder.
So he was quite a lively boy, was he?
Far too bloody lively, yes.
Kids at school were terrified of that.
It's a scary hand. How did you click this closed?
That it was a little gas cylinder I had to wear, and they had to be changed throughout the day and whatnot because they ran out. Mm. And occasionally one of the air pipes had come off the thing, and there'd be this thing snaking around inside my shirt at 100 mile an hour.
Oh, no.
Yeah.
Once we got back to Australia, I spoke to a doctor, and he felt that he could actually put a pair of arms on Brett. And I mentioned this to Brett, and I was told in no uncertain manner what to do with the arms, and they wouldn't have looked pretty there.
Family comes first in Brett's life. His mother's death a year ago was a terrible loss and changed Brett's view of his role, especially towards his aging father.
We don't have power, which is very frustrating because there's not a lot you can do without power, but fortunately we do have gas. So we're trying to build a new shed slash house for my dad to come and live in. And it's running about 3.5 weeks late at the moment.
I wonder why Brett is doing this. Is it to look after his childhood carer?
Right.
No, I'm going out.
Do you want your spin around on the chair first? Better ask your friend first.
You've been a good lad, so we'll give you a good swing. Ooh, that's a crack you want to go. Let me unwind you. Dad and I speak every morning on the phone, you know, and we're sort of very much part of each other's lives in a lot of aspects, and, you know, we talk to each other, you know, often 2 or 3 times a day, and what's going on and what's happening, and it's good. So I'm looking forward to having him here and having 3 generations of Nielsen blokes under the same roof. I think that'll be fantastic.
Given how full Brett's life is already, it's surprising he wants to take on looking after his ailing dad as well. Peter lives in North Sydney on his own, but close to his 2 other sons.
A couple of years ago, he had a heart attack or something and fell over, and he broke both his arms. And I was the one who went and looked after him, which I thought was quite ironic. You know, went and, you know, hung out and helped him get dressed and turn the shower on and cook and rah, 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 and company and all that sort of stuff. So to me, he's looks like he needs a bit of a hand, so to speak. And I just figure that he can probably live a much better life living up here with me than he can living by himself in Sydney with my brothers a mere 5 kilometres away. But anyway, we won't go into that.
I don't think anybody likes being told what they should do. I'm concerned about it because, you know, it's cost him a bloody lot of money, and I don't want the feeling that, you know, I've actually disappointed him or done anything, but I have access to various doctors down here, which I wouldn't have access. Brett says it's only half an hour up the road to the Gold Coast. But I don't particularly want to go to the bloody Gold Coast every second day or so to see a doctor, and that's it.
I don't know how he's going to make up his decision. I don't know what different items he's putting into the mix to sort of try and decide. So he may or may not. Part of him, the trouble to move may be greater than the benefit of actually moving.
Well, I keep putting it in the back of my mind, you know. It's a dilemma.
I feel Brett's trying to force him into accepting the fact that he's built this thing just for Dad. And I think that's wrong. You know, Dad's his own person. He's got his own mind. He's always done his own thing. I understand where Brett's coming from, but I don't see that working. And Brett does not see our point of view. So, sorry, Brett. I don't want him to go.
All the Nielsens seem to have strong opinions. Brett's decision to abandon artificial arms so young was a declaration of independence. But if he couldn't support himself, he could need lifelong financial help from his parents. That was the argument 62 British families used to win a 6-year fight for compensation from Distillers, the company that licensed thalidomide in Britain and the Commonwealth.
The firm which sold the thalidomide drug in Britain has offered to pay £20 million. It will go to more than 300 children born deformed because their mothers took the drug on doctor's orders when they were pregnant.
Distillers also paid modest compensation to 36 Australian children, including Brett. But it went into a trust fund that he could only access a decade later when he was 25. In Sydney, that meant both Nielsens had to work all hours to send the teenage Brett to boarding school. It must have been his next big test. I want to know how he survived with hundreds of adolescent boys. To find out, I've come 3 hours west of Sydney to Scott's school in Bathurst, now co-ed.
The former headmaster.
I thought it would be a very good thing for the school to have Brett with us. And his father was terribly anxious that he should be a normal boy. And he was, to all intents and purposes, though very confident and very competent. An interesting child.
He used to walk around, and he's a bit cocky with that. I don't know how he got away with it, but he used to have the smokes in his top pocket. And I remember him flicking it out and getting on the ground, just pulling one out. And
you'd have a lighter, matches, or whatever. Incredible.
I'd been caught smoking in town in a cafe. And before he wrapped the cane around me, he said, "What the hell did you think you were doing?" And I apparently said, "Well, I didn't think anyone would notice." You're sitting in a cafe smoking a cigarette with your feet and you didn't think anyone would notice.
But you also said that you couldn't be caned because it was against the law.
That was at the state school, because they caned everyone on the hand. But at boarding school, they wrapped a cane around everyone's ass, and I had one of them, so damn.
We also had another situation. He and another boy were going to have a fight. They had a fight. Brett won. That didn't do Brett any harm at all. He grew in the estimation of a lot of the boys in the school.
Anyone sort of said anything wrong or anything, you know, he'd get stuck into him. You know, he could look after himself.
He could kick you just quicker than someone could punch, basically. He was just phenomenally quick on his feet. And he could really defend himself.
We were told, you know, look after your brothers. But that went for the other two looking after me too if I got in the scrap. And Brett came to my aid as well too. I got picked on at Pittwater High. And Brett just walked up, dumped his satchel off his shoulder and kicked the shit out of someone.
Left hand, under there, tight into your shoulder. Right? Lock it in, swing your other arm through. Lose it or eat it.
I didn't enjoy school. You know, I didn't enjoy boarding school at all. I was always on the outer. You know, the whole school was either involved in the school cadets marching around with 303s or in the bagpipe band. And, you know, the saying about, you know, as much as I love music, the idea of me marching, playing bagpipes just didn't seem like a great career move. And the army insisted that the rifle be held with both hands. And so, you know, I was sort of spent a lot of time just doing my own thing.
Left, right.
Brett left school at 15 to become an intern at the local radio station. It was a job that would change his life.
Bit of solid gold for Creedence Clearwater Revival. I put a spell on you. 10 past 12 now from 2MBS FM.
I found kids like that who were determined not allow their disability to become a handicap. And they worked harder, tried harder. And once they got to the normal level of competency, they didn't stop trying.
He came to us from Scott School and they said, look, he has an interest in production and music. He plays piano and he'd love to come in and do some work experience, and we just, with the view to perhaps getting a career in radio, and I think learning the production and giving him the skills, which Brett just then ran with because he ran his own production company, didn't he? And
it still does.
Neighbour had a piano, and I used to go and annoy them, you know, often playing their piano and mucking around with it. And then when I was still at school, a fellow taught me basic chord structure. And so with that, I sort of started, you know, working out how to get my feet around playing chords.
Keeps all people like to think they know who they are. Too many trying to copy.
Songs because it seemed to be something which was interesting to me at the time, because I had a lot of spare time at boarding school, and started bashing away on a piano and decided I was going to become a songwriter. So that's what started off, trying to write songs, and just sort of has progressed ever since then.
Brett's dexterous feet on the keyboard.
Singing and playing his own songs took him into local clubs.
I ran a restaurant in Byron Bay in Johnson Street, and we decided to put on some entertainment.
There is a house in New Orleans.
And then Brett approached us one day to come and play there. And we said, this is unusual, but yeah, give us a go. He was very good. I mean, on stage, he was very entertaining. And we had people coming back basically just to see him. And he had quite a good following, actually.
Love of music also brought Brett his first wife, Lydia. She was 27, Brett was 19.
Mutual friend introduced us whilst we were at the function, and she said, oh, Lyd, Jenny said, Lyd, you'd love to meet Brett. And I went, oh, yeah, okay. So I met Brett, and I didn't even realise that he was in any way unique or different. I just thought he was standing in a crowd of people, and we were just chatting away, and we started to talk about music and playing piano, and I casually mentioned that there was a piano at the house where I was staying, and he said, oh, let's go, I want to play my songs, and I went, oh, all right, and off we trotted, and then we spent the whole night just listening to music, to each other's songs. I think over my time with Brett, as, you know, the best years of my life, we had a ball. We had an absolute ball. And, okay, in the early days we had very little. I mean, we had the house and that was about it. And we slowly pieced together and made it into a beautiful house, and we got the gardens happening and we got the studio built and we did the music and we got into stuff and we were energetic and we did things. And it's when you're in your 30s, you do those things, and we did those things. It was our 30s. It was our, you know, our prime time.
Brett's studio was the key to a successful recording business, including producing 9 CDs of his own relaxation music that sold over 120,000 copies.
Oh, look at that.
Brett's latest project is an album that began 27 years ago and was never released. It's a collection of mostly his own songs called Pigs in Space.
Here we go again, 1, 2, 3, do you want to come and join?
Why did it take 27 years to finish Pigs in Space?
I recorded, you know, all of those songs and a whole bunch more. And then I mixed them on two or three different occasions. And I was never quite happy with the, you know, the product at the end of it. And never quite happy to release that. And then decided we wanted to finish the Pigs in Space project, and that's what we did. Roses are red and violets are blue. Nobody does it for me
like you do. When did you stop singing publicly?
In 1981. I stopped singing publicly. It was the International Year of the Disabled, and I didn't want anyone to get the wrong impression.
What would the wrong impression be?
Well, I don't know, that there was something to do with the Year of the Disabled, you know. I just didn't want to be a part of it.
In a black and white music video, a couple dance near an open fire. Brett and Helen driving in an open-top silver sports car.
Brett's impressive lifestyle contrasts sharply with other surviving thalidomide victims around the world. They've struggled all their lives to win compensation against fierce corporate resistance. Although Brett gained from the settlements, he kept working and avoided the treadmill of legal campaigns, preferring the company of family and friends instead.
I think it all starts from the backyard, really. And I figure if my little world has integrity and all the rest of it, that it can flow out from there. So that's sort of what I mainly concentrate on.
But I was also thinking about you not wanting to be seen as a whinger. What does it mean to be a whinger when you've got a, when there's a really good cause?
Whinging to me is sort of, you know, where ones have got the attitude that the world owes them a living, and I don't believe the world owes anyone a living. You know, I think everyone needs to get up and get happening and do the stuff they got to do.
Whinging in the Nielsen family is strictly taboo. Brett's mother died last year, but her influence still prevails throughout the family.
You could never, ever complain about anything with grandma, because she would shut you down. So, yeah, I definitely think the no whinging comes from grandma.
You could rip off mum's arm and she'd say, just put a band-aid on him, I've got other stuff to do. She really was like that. She was unbelievable.
I used to get so annoyed when he would ask me to, not ask, demand that I should do this and do that, when he would scream so much. But because the child was so handicapped, it seemed even worse to me to feel resentful.
Brett is a young boy with his mum.
Brett's mother realised that her resentment was normal for a young woman with two other children, and so stopped giving in to him automatically. But she also saw that Brett was not just crying for help. He was crying for more independence.
Adult Brett's behind the wheel of a mechanical digger.
I can see Barbara's influence on the way Brett has lived his life. As well as marketing the studio, he bought a small bulldozer and worked on building sites locally for 27 years. It was a high-risk venture, both financially and physically.
It's a bit of a career jump. It's not like, well, the natural progression of my radio career is to go and buy a tractor.
No, it's not. But, I mean, you know, I like driving things, you know that. Yeah. And, you know, I needed to earn some sort of an income somehow, and you know, nothing much was really jumping out, so earth moving seemed like a really good idea.
Brett's willingness to take risks to become independent showed in his teens. With money from a serious bicycle accident, he bought a flat in Sydney and then traded it in for a house that he still lives in 37 years later. He was just 19.
I came for a holiday up this way and came to visit some friends who were living here. And I said, this is such a great place. And they said, yeah, it is. It's such a bummer it's up for sale. So I went and put a $50 holding deposit on it down at the local real estate, went home and sold the other place and bought this one. And
he shrugs. Now Brett's driving a motorised lawnmower.
14 years later, at 33, Brett's independence and fearless way of living were threatened by a near-fatal car accident.
A photograph of a car wreck.
Oh, look at this, Dad.
Oh, my God. It was an F-100. And it was a very, very big accident where a person in a Volvo couldn't drive very well and lost control of their car and crashed into me. I smashed 16 teeth, lip got severed right up into my nostril, broke my nose, stitches in my eye, broke my left leg, a couple of toes on my right foot I broke as well. And it was a bit like having broken arms and legs. I couldn't walk, I couldn't hold a cup, I couldn't hold a cigarette, I couldn't do anything. And my wife had left a couple of months earlier. Damn, damn, damn.
Were you angry? How did you feel about the other driver?
I thought he was a bit of a clown for not being able to drive his car very well. But, you know, accidents happened.
Didn't make you cross?
Cross? No. No, I don't think I was cross. It was more frustrated that, because not being able to walk or anything, it was just very, very difficult to get around. And, you know, a wheelchair, you know, how are you going to go in the wheelchair, Brett? Badly, you know. Crutches? No. And, you know, on and on it went. And so I sort of had to rely on friends more than anything, you know, for better part of a month to do everything, which was, you know, terrible. Terrible.
I'm finding it hard to grasp how calmly Brett seems to deal with adversity. If he wasn't angry at someone who almost killed him, surely he must feel strongly about the scandal of thalidomide and the German company who made it, Grünenthal.
I've seen him cross with people, but I wouldn't say Brett's actually got a temper. Don't see him as that. He can be very cutting with the wit. I think that's what gives him the ability to do such great motivational speaking.
Defeat thing has never really been an issue. It's whatever you're used to as you grow up. I was with my daughter one day, who was 2 or 3 at the time, and she said, "Look, Dad, there's a man playing piano with his hands."
In his 30s, Brett turned his optimism and resilience in the face of his situation into a third career as a motivational speaker. He was in demand all over Australia. He joked about his lack of arms, but stayed clear of thalidomide politics.
As we close, if I was to share some insights about life, which I consider to be important, it would be these few things. The first is personal responsibility. My parents made no special modifications to our home, as they felt that I should adapt to the world and not expect the world to adapt to me. Be kind to yourself. Recognise your achievements. Listen to your heart and follow your dreams. Look around and see the beauty in simplicity. Work hard at whatever is in front of you and know in your bones that you can do anything. And finally, it doesn't matter what happens to you in your life, it matters how you deal with it. Ladies and gentlemen, thank you so much. Good night.
A standing ovation in the room.
Brett now follows those principles in his turn as a dad. He's a single parent to Pasha and to Jack, whom he looks after 4 days a week.
He's my number one support system. Like, he's great. He really supports me with anything I do. He's a great dad.
Someone once said to me that having a child is the greatest love affair of your life, and I think it is. You know, I love the kids, and no one makes me laugh as much as Jack does. He's just hilarious, you know, constantly. We have a cruisy time together, and, you know, we do lots of stuff together. You know, we cook together every night and all of that sort of stuff, and just hang out. It's great.
Here's Jack.
Hi, Jack.
Hey, Dad.
How are you, darling?
Good.
Good. How's your day?
It was pretty good.
Yeah.
He's always been Dad, you know? You know how Dad is. He's sort of like, you know,
dad, the man of the house, you know, dad cooks dinner, I help, you know, that sort of thing. But now it's sort of like, you know, how intense dad's life's been, I want to help more with him, you know, that sort of stuff.
Another part of Brett's life has come into sharper focus. He's increasingly concerned by the behaviour of the makers of thalidomide, Grünenthal.
A few years ago, someone sent me an email about a book about thalidomide, and I've never read any books about thalidomide. You know, what for? You know, the horse is already gone. Let's not bother shutting the gate now, you know. And I must have been very bored the next day or something, because I actually went to the link and sort of had a bit of a look at it, and, you know, as you do, and the entire front cover was a photo of me. And so I had to read the book after that.
Tell me more about the book and what it made you feel at that point.
It made me feel quite incredulous that the whole thing had actually happened. That, you know, yeah, just, you know, this is just outrageous that people could, you know, carry on as they did.
Since the scandal broke in 1961, Grünenthal has always denied responsibility. In the late 60s, the German government took them to court on behalf of the 5,000 German victims. After years of bullying expert witnesses and victims, the leading defense counsel became Minister of Justice. After several secret meetings with the prosecutors, the trial was stopped without a verdict, but with fierce condemnation from the judges. It took until 2012 for the new chief executive to express regret to the victims for what he called 50 years of silent shock. The victims said they would rather have more money. Brett has kept out of the fight until now.
What's the point in being anything with, you know, that situation? I mean, there's absolutely nothing I can do to change it. Nothing.
Yeah, you say it very calmly, you know what I mean?
There are people you could, you know, hate. You could hate them. I would. I think I would. I don't know. What do the other victims feel? Do they hate them? Are they their lives? Because you're very special as a person anyway.
Well, I don't know. I don't know if they hate Grünenthal or whatever. I mean, it seems a little bit sort of counterproductive to hate them. I think they're a bunch of assholes, but I don't hate them, you know. I think the way they went about what they did was absolutely outrageous. But, you know, it's already happened.
Sure.
So, you know, far better to make a statement that, you know, makes them actually respond. I think that'd be great.
Brett's launch of his new CD offers him the chance to challenge Grünenthal. It's taken 27 years to complete the album.
Sorry. They've choreographed it to your...
And even longer for him to take on the company that made thalidomide.
Action!
I want to do some videos to promote the album, and as an added extra, I thought it'd be really cool to make a statement about Grünenthal. And, you know, Grünenthal just haven't really done the right thing. It's just really, really wrong, and I believe they should be held accountable for their actions and for the products that they've produced. And I'm probably old enough now to talk about it, you know, whereas probably before I wasn't, you know, a bit young and silly.
I think this is beautiful, this tape.
Oh, yeah, this is cool, nice. I love this stuff.
It's a bit American Gothic or something, isn't it? And she goes...
Fantastic, well done.
Brett has recently taken on a lot of responsibility. The album, 2 music videos, building a house for his dad, and raising Jack on his own.
The ones are better than the white ones.
Really?
Yeah.
Doing all this with no arms and very little help carries a major risk.
Good morning, Brett. How are you?
Good.
That his body could suddenly let him down.
I'm all set up for you.
Good on you.
Come in. Make yourself comfy. I'll be with you when you're ready.
Thank you.
Good.
This is not one of those sort of movies. It's a family show. That's right. Off you go.
Okay.
I want to know from Peter, Brett's physio and close friend, what's the long-term physical cost of Brett's remarkable independence?
Brett, basically because of his disability, he works with his legs a lot. And there is obviously more wear and tear in his pelvis, in his legs, his knees, as there would be with other people. So my focus is mainly on balancing the pelvis, straighten his hips, keep his spine in good working order. And I work a lot on his feet to make sure mobility remains good. And over the years, he's been pretty stable, and you've seen him in action, so it's quite remarkable. When I see him operate his hands, his feet, I'm so impressed. The thumb, the joints in his hands are so much more mobile. They are meant to do fine work. The fine motor skills are much more developed in the hands. But when I look at Brett's fine motor skills that he uses with his feet, it's remarkable.
How are you?
Good, how are you?
Good, thanks. You know, it's all good.
Did Brett ever imagine having arms or feel phantom pain in the missing limbs?
He told me this one story. It was painting his house, painting up on the ceiling. 1 foot had the paintbrush, 1 foot had the paint pot, and he was sitting on the ladder painting. He fell over, and he said the first and only time in his life he wanted to use hands to soften the fall, but still no phantom pain. But he said he had this feeling arms were growing in that second where he fell to soften the fall. And I thought, wow, that's a remarkable experience.
Peter Wuchera, physiotherapist.
Brett's plan to move his father next door is on hold. The new house is months late with serious building problems. He shows them to his friend Trevor, a property developer. For a start, there are no handrails on the stairs or veranda. Risky for a man with no arms and his 83-year-old father who has trouble walking.
Oh, gee.
You know, that shouldn't be like that. And the other thing is that there's a beam running along here, all the way along there.
But it's not here.
All the way down the other side, and it's not here.
Well, there it is down there, but it's in the wrong place.
I think so.
I'm staggered they've done this to you, Bill, right? Absolutely. Yeah.
And they demanded full payment, last final payment before Christmas.
But they hadn't finished.
They hadn't done very much by then at all.
I hate to have to say it, Brett, but I think you've been taken advantage of in this circumstance.
I think I have, Trev.
Yet again, Brett seems calm in the face of things that would have me climbing the wall, like Grünenthal or the construction problems.
Brett doesn't show a lot of emotion outside. He's very controlled, and I think that also comes from the fact that when you're at school, through back to his schooling again, he would have had a lot of cruel things said to him, I'm sure, and he learned to insulate himself, so not to show emotion, and I think that's where that would have come from.
Helen found the same reaction when they were disturbed at a restaurant.
We'd had a lovely evening, really nice evening, and chattering away, and this drunk walked up and started, just being loud-mouthed, wasn't he?
He was.
Obnoxious.
He was fascinated by the situation and couldn't help but to say something, and in doing so, he was, taking up our space, basically.
The way Brett deals with that, I found that really extraordinary, because I wanted to get out and snot them. Because that seemed fair and reasonable.
Well, losing control, I mean, if you're, you know, telling someone to fuck off, essentially you've lost control.
Mm-hmm. Of course we felt sorry for him while he was young, but as he grew older and was quite happy, there was no need to feel sorry. Why should one feel sorry for a happy person?
The family have seen the original film before, but I want to show it to them again to see if it sheds any light on what lies behind Brett's incredible composure.
The family are watching film of Brett and his brother wrestling.
Don't touch it! Don't!
He kicks the boy in the head.
He sees the world.
That's brutal.
I'd say deserved it, prisoner.
You still believe that?
Yeah.
I do. I've always thought that, you know. And I figure that mostly when I meet people for the first time, they sort of go into some sort of state of shock. Basically, And all of the layers of bullshit that everyone has up to impress and or whatever else are stripped off. And I get to see the real person.
The Nielsens, like many other parents, had already been through a frustrating series of hospital visits. Thalidomide problems were new and so complex that most doctors were caught unprepared.
It was a very intense time for me as a young child.
Yeah, really?
Oh, shit, you. Yeah, well, you know, I spent 3 months in hospital. Mum and Dad came and visited every Sunday because it was 70 miles away or something, and once a week for a few hours sort of thing, and on and on I went. So it's a lot of separation anxiety and something like that.
Poor you.
Well, you know.
Yeah, what, it's just sad to watch it. It's really sad. It's like, Dad with no arms now isn't sad. That's just Dad. But a child with no arms is really, really tragic.
Yeah, tough times.
Aww.
Yesterday when we watched one of them as Brett all together, I mean, last night it sort of stirred up a few things, and I sort of realised that there was a whole bunch of memories or whatever about those times that I've basically fairly successfully stood on and, you know, repressed for 50 years, feeling a little bit sort of abandoned, really, you know, and left in hospitals and whatnot. And I totally understand and realise that my parents were doing the absolute best they could for me because they loved me so much and all of that sort of stuff. But the, you know, at the end of the day, the feeling is still there of some sort of abandonment as a youngster.
Brett is a boy with a balloon in his mouth.
I never knew that Brett spent 3 months in hospital being fitted for arms, largely on his own at the age of three. He'd already lived through it by the time I filmed him a year later. With the house in limbo and his dad still undecided about the move, Brett turns his energy back to his album and the protest video.
It's a tricky one. It's about Grunen.
Simon, the director, and his editor, Julie, have come to Brett's house to produce it.
When was it actually banned?
It was released in October 57.
Yeah.
And it was banned worldwide in 61.
In 61, yeah. Right. I personally never realised the extent to which Grunenthal were like, whoops.
Yeah.
That seems to be their attitude, like...
50 years is ridiculous.
Well, the really, other thing...
You know, having been held accountable for.
The other thing about Grunenthal is that the brothers, the Wirtz brothers who had it running, were good Nazi party members.
And, oh, God.
And the people who invented the drugs and who worked for Grunenthal were all out of the camps.
Oh, my.
And all of the doctors or whatever they were who were testing stuff and doing experiments on the Jews and rah, rah, rah. And they're the guys who invented thalidomide and they're the guys who worked for Grunenthal.
That adds a very sinister dimension, doesn't it?
Well, it does. And I just figure that no one seems to have had a great deal of success in doing anything with Grunenthal.
I see.
And I'd love to embarrass the bastards. Really, really embarrass them.
Brett going public about his feelings is another big step for him.
I'm not looking for money from Grunenthal for me. I'm really not. But there's a lot of people who aren't in my position, who haven't been as fortunate one way or another with, you know, their ability to work or whatever it is. And, you know, there's a whole lot of people out there who are having a really shitty time. Shitty, shitty time. And it's wrong. And the second one for me.
The protest video is Brett's way of finally joining the 50-year campaign against those who made the drug.
Go. Thalidomide.
Every woman must be aware that it's most important that they do not take this drug.
We're looking at the very worst disaster inflicted by medicine.
Isn't it a pity? Isn't it a shame how we break each other's hearts and cause each other pain.
Half a century after my film about a determined four-year-old, I see a happy man driven by love of his children, of his father, who has now decided to move into the new house, and now Helen. Inspired by her, Brett is writing songs again, and he no longer hides his feelings about Grünenthal.
Isn't it a pity?
It has been a privilege to share a small part of the journey of this extraordinary, ordinary man.
Years ago, I sat down, I was feeling miserable about something, glum, as Helen would say, and I sat down with a bit of paper and a pen and I wrote down all of the things that I wanted in my life, you know, sort of the, you know, the most extreme things that I could think of. And I wrote them all down and looked at it all and went, oh, I've got them all. You know, I want to live in a big house. I want to have a view of a mountain. I want to live near the water, have a recording studio in the backyard. I mean, really, you know, beautiful kids, girlfriend, dog.
Children in Brazil, 2012.
Researchers report that thalidomide children continue to be born.
How we break each other's hearts.
What many saw as corporate greed at its worst.
And cause each other.
The music video with footage of Brett as a boy, then driving.
How we take each other's hearts. Without thinking anymore.
It's an absolute displacement.
Brett playing piano, then taking his headphones off.
Isn't it a pity?
Young Brett pedaling a tricycle, then a headline. Drug firm Grünenthal apologizes for thalidomide.
Isn't it a pity?
Someone putting a jumper on for Brett. Young Brett with his mother.
Mm-hmm.